Welcome to the Studying the Bible podcast, where every Thursday, Pastors Dylan Dodson and Brian Androsian study a book of the Bible, verse by verse, to see what is being communicated and how we can use it to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We pray that today's podcast can help you grow just a little bit closer to Christ.
Welcome back to our online Bible study through the book of Esther. In this fourth session, we will actually be in Esther chapter 4. Now, where we left off is that an edict, spurred on by Haman, but approved by King Ahasuerus, has gone throughout the kingdom of Persia that on a specific date, all of the Jews can be killed, that you can go out and kill the Jewish people, your neighbors, you can take from them whatever you want, all because Mordecai, who was a Jew, wouldn't bow down to Haman, who is now the highest ranking official in the kingdom other than King Ahasuerus. So Haman came up from this plan because, as we saw last time, he's an Agagite. The Agagites and the Jews are lifetime mortal enemies. And Haman doesn't just want to destroy Mordecai. He wants to use this as an opportunity to destroy all the Jews. Comes with a plan. Ahasuerus approves it. And there's going to become an appointed time when really legal genocide can take place against the Jews. So here's what happens. Chapter 4, verse 1. Here's what happens next. It says this. When Mordecai learned all that had occurred, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the middle of the city and cried loudly and bitterly. Right? So, understandably, Mordecai is intensely grieved over the edict. It's also just helpful to know that in the West, in the United States, you know, we keep our emotions to ourselves. I mean, maybe around certain people, we'll kind of let it out, but in public, we like to tell people we're okay. We don't want to inconvenience anyone. We don't want to let people know necessarily that we're sad, and so we keep it all in. But in more Oriental cultures, and for most ancient cultures, it was common to show your grief publicly. If somebody had died, if something really difficult had happened to you or your family, people would know about it. You wouldn't try to keep it so close to your chest. And so he tore his clothes, which again was a common way of showing grief in the Old Testament and in the ancient world. He put on sackcloth and ashes, which is typically a garment made of goat hair, and ashes spread on his hair, or spread on your hair, which, to be honest, is actually really uncomfortable. Like, it's not just that you would maybe don attire that signified you were grieving. What you were actually wearing was also uncomfortable. Really, it was a physical reminder of the internal pain that you were feeling. So clearly, genocide coming to your people is a devastated thing, and he is in mourning because of it. And so it says this, verse 2. He, being Mordecai, went only as far as the king's gate, since the law prohibited anyone wearing sackcloth from entering the king's gate. There was a great mourning among the Jewish people in every province where the king's command and edict came. They fasted, wept, and lamented, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Mordecai is mourning. All the Jewish people who hear about it are understandably mourning because they can't do anything. And it's like a collective sign of grief and sadness and despair about what was going to happen. Now, maybe you and I can't relate to this specifically, like genocide is going to happen to you, but you do know what it's like when you receive terrible news and just the sinking feeling that happens, right? Maybe someone in your family dies unexpectedly, or even expectedly, it's really difficult. Or maybe you realize a dream that you've been working towards is not going to happen. Maybe there's a medical diagnosis for you or someone you love that is not good. Right? It is deeply depressing and deeply difficult. Or maybe on a communal suffering level, I think if you were alive and can remember 9/11, where the trade towers came down from the airplanes, from the terrorist attacks, and the Pentagon and all those things, you can remember the communal suffering that our country did together. That we didn't pretend like nothing was wrong. We knew something was wrong. And so all of us as a country were grieving together. Right, you can kind of remember where you were when it happened on that day if you were alive and old enough to remember. And that's what's happening here. Deep, communal, awful suffering over what has been told is going to happen to them. Verse 4. Esther's female servants and her eunuchs came and reported the news to her, and the queen was overcome with fear. She sent clothes for Mordecai to wear so that he would take off his sackcloth, but he did not accept them. Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who attended her, and dispatched him to Mordecai to learn what he was doing and why. So again, as we saw in last session, the last episode of this Bible study, that Esther had been queen for about, probably at this point, a little over 5 years. And still, she's kept tabs with Mordecai. In fact, her wanting to send clothes to Mordecai may be so that he could enter the king's gate and that so she could have a private meeting with him. And so he rejects, which means she can't go to him, and also would imply that she was Jewish in some sense, right? That if she does go out to him outside of the gate to meet with someone who is mourning, there might be some implication, well, why is she with a mourning Jew unless she also is Jewish? And so she rejects them, so she sends the eunuch to see what is going on. Right, she wants to know what's happening. She can't meet with Mordecai, and so she sows and sees why he is so upset, or to see what was happening. And so, verse 6, and then it says this. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened, as well as the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay the royal treasury for the slaughter of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa, ordering their destruction, so that Hathach might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and command her to approach the king, implore his favor, and plead with him personally for her people. Right, so Mordecai, again, essentially explains the situation to the eunuch, gives him instructions for Esther on what she should do to encourage him to stand in the gap and to make this not happen, maybe somehow make it go away. So verse 9, it says, Hathach came and reported Mordecai's response to Esther. Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to tell Mordecai, all the royal officials and the people of the royal provinces know that one law applies to every man or woman who approaches the king in the inner courtyard and who has not been summoned, the death penalty, unless the king extends the gold scepter, allowing that person to live. I have not been summoned to appear before the king for the last 30 days. Now, here's the reality. It was law, because Mordecai wants Esther to go before the king and plead this case. Well, she can't unless the king summons her, right? It was law that no one except the seven eunuchs, as we'll see, in his inner court, could approach the king without being invited. You could not come unannounced. And if you did, it was punishable by death. She could have requested to meet with the king, and she doesn't do it here. We're not told why she didn't at least request it, but she didn't. It could be this. Why didn't she, maybe doesn't go storm into the king's royal court, why didn't she ask him? Again, difficulty about the book of Esther. A lot of things happens, we don't know why. But it could be a couple of reasons. It could be that the king's affection for her had cooled, right? That she'd been queen for over 5 years. Of course, as king, he had plenty of women to do whatever he wanted with. And with Esther not seeing him for 30 days, it could point to maybe something had happened that made him upset. So perhaps she knew that it wouldn't work if she requested an audience, or maybe she didn't want to draw attention from others on what she wanted to see the king for, right? Because you didn't really meet with the king privately. And so maybe she didn't want to request a meeting with the king because she might have to reveal what the meeting would have been about, and she doesn't want people to know. So regardless, for whatever reason, she doesn't go before the king. And so here is the here's what she decides in verse 12. Esther's response was reported to Mordecai. Again, that she's not going to do it, essentially. Verse 13, Mordecai told the messenger to reply to Esther, "Don't think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you are in the king's palace. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place, but you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Now, to be fair here, in these couple of verses, 12 through 14, there's a lot of debate around this exchange and what is actually going on, right? Is Mordecai threatening Esther? Like, if you don't go before the king, I will reveal your identity. Or is he saying or actually trusting that God will deliver his people, so don't miss your chance to play a part of it, right? Is he saying that I believe that God's going to deliver us, and you can play a part in making this happen, or you cannot, but it's going to happen. So maybe out of faith, he is encouraging her or wanting her to do something. Or is he saying that this was God's plan all along, right? To have you come to power for this exact moment, Right, again, we don't know for sure the motivations or what is driving him to get her to go before the king, other than survival. But what is he thinking is going to come of it? We don't know. But now Esther has to make a choice. And there is no neutral position to take here, right? And again, we're not Esther. We're likely never going to be in a situation like this. But we do know what it's like to be in a very difficult position where you don't know where the right answer is. I mean, imagine being in this situation where the wrong answer can not only get you killed, but can get everybody killed. This is, again, where Esther finds herself in an impossible situation where there does not seem to be any good alternative or good choice. So here's what it says next, verse 15. Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Here's what she decides to do. Verse 16, go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. After that, I will go to the king, even if it is against the law. If I perish, I perish. So here, Esther has chosen that she is going to essentially reveal her Jewish identity and give faithfulness to God with whatever he decides to do. Of course, as we've talked about previously, she has assimilated in many ways, but now displays even more courage than Vashti and Mordecai. Vashti in chapter 1 was a courageous thing to say no to the king. Mordecai not bowing down to Haman was a courageous thing, but she now has to literally possibly give up her life and die for what she is going to do. Or put another way, what we see happening here is that she decides to place the good of others before her own sense of safety and well-being and is willing to risk her life. Willing to risk her life. And so that's what she does. Now, you may think that Esther is courageous, which, of course, you would rightly think that. But you also may be thinking, well, I'll never be, again, as we talked about, in a position like her, right? But I love what Karen Jobe says about this passage and her commentary in the book of Esther. It's really, to make this practical for us, I love what she says. She says it this way. She said, it is unlikely that any of us will ever be in Esther's dire predicament, right? Which is true. But every one of us faces defining moments in our own lives. Certainly, the most fundamental of them comes when we hear the gospel of Jesus Christ and decide how to respond to it. The gospel confronts us with the decision either to continue to live as pagans or to identify ourselves with God's people, the church. Our choice defines who we are and with what people we identify. Right? This is what Esther has to do. She has to make a choice. Her own safety, what she might think is her own good, or is she going to side with God's people and let whatever come, come? So again, I'll read verse 15, this time to the end of the chapter to see what happens. It says this, Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. After that, I will go to the king, even if it is against the law. If I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went and did everything that Esther had commanded him. Right? So Esther has a plan. She's going to fast night and day for 3 days, which is significant as fasting typically was often just done during the day. There's Jewish fasts and various things where you wouldn't eat from sunrise to sundown, but she clearly here wants to do a complete fast. Now, again, here's the thing about fasting. Fasting in our culture today is not done very, very much, at least compared to ancient Christianity, because it's hard. Now, one of the reasons is we don't do it as much is because, well, we don't have to, right? While you may not make as much as you want to make and maybe live where you want to live, generally speaking, though certainly not always the case, but for the majority of Americans, you can be fed. You can be satisfied. You can not have to go without your basic needs being met. But fasting is where we deny our needs, and it shows us our need for God and for Him to move. And it reminds us, our hunger reminds us, that we don't live on bread alone. That without God, our being doesn't even happen. It's a constant reminder of our need for Him. It's reminding ourselves to be who God has called us to be when we go to Him in fasting and prayer. And in chapter 4 ends in this way. We don't know what's going to happen. But we see Esther and Mordecai and maybe many other Jews who had fallen off and had assimilated and were not being faithful to God, now turning back to Him at their most pressing need. And so that being said, I just want to leave with two thoughts, two concluding thoughts from Esther chapter 4. Here's the first one. especially when it comes to Esther and us maybe thinking, knowing that we're never going to be in a position like her. It's important to remember this, that you can't change the world for everyone, but you can change the world for someone, right? The decisions that you and I make don't really, are kingdoms and genocides and wiping out and massive destruction of human life don't really come to decisions that you and I can influence. However, we can make a world of difference in people's lives around us. It's also, I think it's important to remember that God has not called us to change the world. And our culture today, where we're told we can do whatever we want and we're perfect just the way we are, and if you're going to be faithful, you got to do all these massive things and a big crowd and have a lot of audience and a big influence and followers and money and prestige and all these things. God doesn't promise that, nor does God ask us to change the world, right? Only one person can change the world, Jesus, and he did. He's simply asking us to be faithful where we are. And so we should ask ourselves, while we can't change the world for everyone, knowing that God hasn't asked us to do that, we can change the world for someone. Who are the people in our lives that we can love, encourage, be generous with our time and our resources with, care for? Who are the people in our sphere of influence in our world that we can make a difference in? We're not Esther, but God hasn't asked us to be. How can we be faithful where we are? You can't change the world for everyone, but you can change the world for someone. And the second thing is this, that in order to do what God has called you to do, you must be who God has called you to be, right? In order to do what God has asked you and called you to do, you must be who God has called you to be, to faithfully love him, care for him, and honor him in your life. That actually empowers you to do what he's asking you to do. He's not asking you to do it on your own or in your own power. He's asking you to be in fellowship with him and following him and inviting other people into the kingdom. We all know this. Our motivations and our desires impact our actions. And so instead of focusing on all the things I need to do, we should ask the power of the Spirit that God would transform us into the type of people that he is calling us to be loving and to be caring and to be generous and to be forgiving, even when people wrong us, to be gracious, even when it's hard, right? To live out these things that sound really good in theory until they're actually put to the test, that God, through the power of his Spirit, would make us someone who is caring and gracious so that when the time comes, we can actually do the work of being caring and gracious. In order to do what God has called you to do, you must be who God has called you to be. What are the spiritual practices and rhythms that you need to develop or you need to continue in your life to be that type of person in response to the gospel, the good news that Christ has come and gave his life to us, to invite us into his kingdom? What does it look like to live in a way that honors him so that as many other people as possible can taste and see that the Lord is good, and also stand into the gap so that they can experience a taste of God's kingdom here on earth and here in this life? So as we end Esther chapter 4, we don't know what's going to happen, but we see people faithfully responding to God, and it's a good reminder in our own life. When we face difficulty, do we run from God or do we turn towards him? The Jews here are going to turn towards him, and we'll see what happens next in Esther chapter 5.